is going to be talking about an alleyway in hell, China's black jails. That's part of our celebration of the 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic. I'm not going to introduce today's speaker. I'm going to ask Len Apkar, who is the deputy managing editor of the International Herald Tribune, also an FCC member who runs the Asia operations, to come up and introduce his colleague and star correspondent. Thank you, Len.
Thank you, Tom. It is wonderful to see this full room and to see so many friends of the Herald Tribune on what has to be one of the nicest days in Hong Kong in a long, long time. This is really a great afternoon. Introducing Jane Perlez is easy. I've worked with Jane a long time, so I'll give you the basics. Jane is Australian. Jane grew up in Sydney. Jane has been a distinguished correspondent for the New York Times for more than 20 years. This year, Jane shared a Pulitzer Prize for her extraordinary, and I don't use that word lightly, work in Pakistan. Those are the basics. Now I want to tell you a few short stories about this business of foreign reporting we all love, and about Jane, who I've known for many years. Whenever I come into this room, particularly to talk about with a foreign correspondent, I always pass that gigantic poster of Love is a Many Splendored Thing on the wall. And there's a little passage that's kind of fun for us writers between Jennifer Jones and William Holden. And it's at the very beginning of the movie, and the electricity is starting to flow between the two of them, and Jennifer Jones turns to William Holden here in Hong Kong and says, coyly, "So you're a writer." And he says, puffs out his chest in the William Holden way, stands tall and says, "Actually, I'm a foreign correspondent." And she says, fairly different, yeah, she says, "What's the difference?" And he says, indignantly, $10 a week. Foreign correspondence is many, many things, but it's not about the money. Foreign correspondence is about the art of storytelling, about understanding a culture, a complex political and social dynamic. It is about being there before the headlines grow large and before the camera crews arrive and the bloggers now start banging away. We all know that reporting of great foreign correspondence can change the course of human events. We've seen it many times. I've seen it happen again and again with Jane Perlez's work. From Africa and Eastern Europe, Indonesia, and now Pakistan, Jane Perlez's coverage has changed the direction of events. During the tragic famine inside Somalia in 1992, Jane managed to be the first reporter to witness the unbearable suffering and disease inside Somalia. The first President Bush, so moved by her stories, turned a modest humanitarian American airlift into a full-blown United States Air Force effort, bringing food and humanitarian aid to the Somalis. In Eastern Europe in 1998, after the brutal, absolutely brutal massacre of Albanian Kosovar guerrillas and their families, Richard Holbrooke picked up Jane's story describing the carnage and used it to persuade President Clinton that Slobodan Milosevic must not get away with this. Not after the Dayton Accords that Richard Holbrooke negotiated. Soon after, President Clinton ordered up a U.S.-led NATO Air Force strike in Serbia. Now, a correspondent is lucky to get just one story in their whole career that plays out like that. I just told you about two for Jane Perlez. Now we come to Pakistan, where Jane has been on the ground for 2 years, long before anybody else. Who knows how this story will play out? But Jane is there, digging and explaining, illuminating a story that has profound implications for international security. The Pulitzer Board called this work by the Times masterful, groundbreaking, reporting frequently done under perilous conditions. For decades, this club has been a beacon to foreign correspondents of all stripes. And today, I'm really pleased to welcome to the FCC my friend and colleague, foreign correspondent Jane Perlez.
I'm really honored to be here at the Foreign Correspondents Club. I first came to this amazing city as an Australian university student. It was the late 1960s, and I came with 50 colleagues from mainland China, where we had just witnessed the tumult of the Cultural Revolution firsthand. In Hong Kong, Western journalists were reduced to listening to Mao's propaganda radio, and here we were, fresh from seeing 1 million Red Guards on the streets of Shanghai and meeting Foreign Minister Chen Yi in Beijing. I was one of the lucky ones. I was taken to lunch to the original Jimmy's Kitchen by New York Times veteran Tilman Durden and fresh from Vietnam, Charlie Moore. That serendipitous meeting had nothing to do with my joining the Times, except it left an indelible impression of excellence in reporting. I'm particularly proud to be here on behalf of the Herald Tribune. Len is the top gun of the Asia edition, a dear friend, my best mate at the paper. We go back many years, many adventures in many parts of the world, and Len, I look forward to more. I'm here to talk about Pakistan, about why it is important, and what the stakes are for the United States. The front page news is about the terror attacks across Pakistan, as the Taliban, their Al-Qaeda backers, and various other militant groups, all mixed into one extremely toxic cocktail, take the war to Pakistan's cities. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda behind them are making these attacks in the cities as the army, the wealthiest, most pampered institution in the country, battle the militants in remote South Waziristan. Obviously, these attacks are reprisals intended to weaken the resolve of the army and the Pakistani people and to force negotiations. And that is what the Pakistani army has done in the past, negotiated. Let's see what they do this time. I was in South Waziristan last week on an army-arranged tour. The only way for foreign journalists, and indeed for most Pakistani journalists, to get to South Waziristan is with the army. South Waziristan is the southernmost part of the semi-autonomous tribal region, and all of the tribal region abuts Afghanistan. The tribal region is off limits to foreign reporters. Special permission to go there is rarely given. And if you are foolhardy enough to go without permission, the odds are pretty high that you'll be kidnapped by one of the militant groups or seized by one of the government's intelligence agencies. Still, the day trip organized by the army was valuable. It made perfectly clear why the area is perfect for Al-Qaeda and its Taliban supplicants to sequester themselves there to plot and plan. The landscape is a sort of geological wonderland. Rocky, barren, dry, big ups and downs, and barely populated at all. About 500,000 people live there in mud-walled compounds. Most of the civilians anticipated the army's offensive and have left in the past 3 months. The Pakistan Army's battle against the Taliban in South Waziristan is now in its third week, but it may not be quite all it seems. First of all, many of the militants have scattered and have fled. And the army is being very selective in who it hits in this toxic cocktail of militants. The army is aiming at the Pakistani Taliban, the group that has made most of the attacks in the cities. It is ignoring the Afghan Taliban, which keeps its sanctuaries in the tribal areas and then travels over the border to Afghanistan to hit American and NATO troops. The Afghan Taliban remain assets of the Pakistani military and are positioned mostly in North Waziristan, not South. And the Pakistanis have left Al-Qaeda to the Americans to deal with, chiefly through drone attacks. Before I say more about the present, I want to set the scene. To understand Pakistan in 2009, it is imperative to understand a few basic themes. Pakistan today is governed by an extremely weak and corrupt civilian government, headed by President Asif Ali Zardari, an accidental president who came to this position when his wife, Benazir Bhutto, was assassinated in December 2007. This government is presented by Washington as the administration's ally and the linchpin of Washington's relationship with Pakistan. The Obama administration wants to make the understandable point that a democratically elected government is its preference to the rule of the military. No problem there. But this government is exceedingly unpopular with the people, mainly because of the corruption cases filed against Mr. Zardari when he served as investment minister in the 1990s during his wife Benazir Bhutto's time as prime minister. These corruption cases are still a huge issue in Pakistan. Why? Because as part of the deal ginned up by the Bush administration and the British to sideline President Musharraf and bring back Ms. Bhutto in 2007, Washington agreed that all corruption cases involving major Pakistani politicians would be given amnesty under something called the National Reconciliation Order. This order is still at the center of Pakistan's never-ending political games. The Zardari government planned to cement this amnesty by putting it before the parliament this week. On Monday, they suddenly withdrew that plan. I wouldn't be surprised if those plans to absolutely guarantee the amnesty was even too much for the Americans. But talking of the Americans, it was very interesting to hear Hillary Clinton, when she was in Pakistan last week, stress the importance of democratic governance. But not once did I hear her say, "We support the Zardari government." Washington understands the corruption of the Zardari government, but they find him conveniently compliant. The recipe of leaders who are corrupt but compliant sounds familiar from past playbooks of American foreign policy, and that playbook has never had a happy ending. The economic crisis under the government has gotten worse. Why? There has been a systematic looting of national assets in the last year. Electric power, power shortages have crippled industry, frustrated ordinary Pakistanis. The main reason is corruption within the distribution companies and political games among the power plant owners and the government. The national steel mill that made profits for 7 years suddenly lost massive money in the past year. And sugar prices have gone through the roof, hurting poor Pakistanis as politically connected mill owners profiteer. And let me stress, most of the money made in these deals is shipped out of the country to Dubai, to London. An Indian official acknowledged the other day that they suffer from a lot of corruption in India, but at least, he said, we keep the money at home. A raid against this civilian government, and I say against, is the military. The top brass of the army and the regular soldiers hold the government in contempt. Under General Kiani, the current chief of staff, it is unlikely the army will step in and take over as it has many times during the country's 62-year history. General Kiani is considered to be less political than many previous chiefs of staff and more interested in preserving the institution he runs. But even so, it was the army that led the charge last month against the American aid legislation that promises to bring $7.5 billion in development assistance, roads, dams, power stations, not fighter jets or tanks, over the next 5 years. The army used some conditions written into the Washington legislation to embarrass the Zardari government and to drive home to the public the Zardari government is a mere stooge of Washington, a songline that boosted the always bubbling anti-American sentiment in Pakistan. In the last 6 months, the army has suddenly moved to take on the Taliban. The army had to. In April, the Taliban was 60 miles from the capital. In May, the army took on the Taliban in Swat, killed many of them, and scattered the leadership. With the backing of Al-Qaeda, the militants are determined to bring down Pakistan. And finally, the army saw that India, its arch enemy for 62 years, was not its only enemy. The decision by the army to take on the militants is a big change, even if they are taking on just a portion of that toxic militant cocktail. In the years of General Musharraf, when the Bush administration was shipping billions of dollars in military assistance, Musharraf arrested a few Al-Qaeda types to appease the Americans. But Musharraf and the then director of the Premier Spy Agency, General Kiani, now the army chief, refrained from taking on the ever-growing menace of the Taliban. The Taliban got stronger, in part, because they became fortified by jihadi groups trained by the army in the 90s as proxies to take on India in Kashmir. These jihadis have now turned on the state and act in concert with the Taliban, forming an important part of the network of terrorists. Behind this picture of anemic government, strong army, and industrial strength insurgency are two basic historical facts that I think help us understand why Pakistan is the way it is today. First, at partition from India in 1947, Pakistan, unlike India, did not have any meaningful land reform. The land in Pakistan remained in the hands of the big landowners. To this day, they are referred to as the feudals, and their life is rather feudal. They have poor serfs working the land for them. In their homes, they have squadrons of servants. In parts of Sindh, where President Zardari comes from, human rights groups estimate there are about 1 million indentured servants. I call the feudals the tea trolley set. When I first went to Islamabad 2 years ago, I was astonished to see that the landed class, the retired bureaucrats and generals, sit around in their living rooms in quite elegant villas in Islamabad and Lahore. They take afternoon tea, British style, circa 1900. It comes on a trolley, pushed by a servant, who pours the tea, always under a cozy, and he serves the paper-thin sandwiches, scones, and samosas. This powerful landlord class pays virtually no tax, and this landlord class makes up a large number of the members of parliament. They get elected and re-elected because their electorate is often made up of their own workers. Just as importantly, because the landlords virtually dominate parliament, there has never been any meaningful tax reform in Pakistan. Why would they tax themselves? Pakistan's tax to GDP ratio has hovered around 9%, about the same rate as Uganda. As points of comparison, India has a tax to GDP ratio of about 17%, and Turkey's is 31%. Another important historical element to understand is the period of the 1980s, when General Zia-ul-Haq ran the country. He was America's guy who allowed the CIA to organize the Mujahideen from the Northwest Frontier Province to go into Afghanistan to battle the Soviets. Zia also Islamicized the society and introduced a heavy Islamic curriculum in the schools and in the army that still exists today. This volatile mix of a rich feudal and leisured class with an Islamicized underclass and a somewhat Islamicized army, particularly at the lower ranks, makes it very difficult for Pakistan to confront the Taliban and Al-Qaeda insurgency. But the primary explanation of why the army and the civilian governments have been reluctant to take on the militants is the state's view of Pakistan's strategic position. Pakistan sees itself surrounded by a much larger, stronger India. And these militants serve, as I mentioned earlier, as Pakistan's proxies against India. Pakistan not only sees India as its huge enemy to the east, it also sees India making big inroads in Afghanistan and thus encircling Pakistan. Let's come to the United States and the Obama administration. The main goal of the Obama administration is to try and achieve a stable Pakistan, a goal that is important for two very obvious reasons. First, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and at the same time is confronted with this debilitating insurgency that would probably like to get its hands on those weapons. Second, though it is not often stated explicitly enough, Pakistan is exceedingly important for the future of Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is important for the future of Pakistan. To achieve this goal of stability in Pakistan, the Obama administration, as I noted earlier, decided that a civilian government was a better bet than the Pakistani military. But as I noted, the Zardari government is extremely unpopular. And the United States is also very unpopular. And that's the case for a number of reasons. Among the Pakistani establishment, Washington is seen as a fickle friend. Here today, gone tomorrow. The Reagan administration used Pakistan as the launching pad for the fight against the Soviets and ginned up the Mujahideen religious fighters out of the tribal lands to take on the Soviets. When the Soviets left Afghanistan, the United States pretty much left Pakistan, slapped on sanctions for the nuclear weapons, and ignored Pakistan all through the 90s as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda nexus grew in Afghanistan. On the Pakistani street today, America's presence in Afghanistan is seen as an occupying power. And the common belief is if only America left Afghanistan, militancy would go away. This mixture of unpopular Zardari government and unpopular Americans backing Zardari leaves the Obama administration in a very tricky position. The emotional feelings towards the United States are very serious. A highly respected former Pakistani diplomat, someone who really admires the United States and who served in the embassy in Washington, told me the other day, many Pakistani officials would just like the United States to go away. They feel if America went away, then the militancy would go away. Under these circumstances, what can the United States do? Pakistan's stability, meaning getting rid of the toxic mix of Islamic militants, cannot be achieved until Pakistan changes its behavior towards those militants. To change its behavior towards those militants, Pakistan has to believe they are no longer useful as weapons now or in the future against India. Pakistan sees India not only as a much stronger hostile country that dwarfs theirs, but sees India's presence in Afghanistan, as I mentioned, as aimed directly at keeping Pakistan in its place. The Pakistanis are also annoyed that the Americans allow the Indian presence in Afghanistan to such an extent. The Pakistanis see big development projects and they see an oversized Indian intelligence network inside Afghanistan. As a candidate, Obama made the point several times that Pakistan could not be seen as a problem on its own, that it had to be viewed as part of a regional solution. He suggested the way to lower tensions between India and Pakistan was to solve the Kashmir issue. The biggest block between decent relations between India and Pakistan, one that has poisoned relations since 1947, when the Hindu ruler of Kashmir, whose population was majority Muslim, decided to join India. Obama understood to change Pakistan's behavior, in effect to have Pakistan save itself, the United States had to broker meaningful dialogue between Pakistan and India. The groundwork was laid during the Musharraf years, and secret talks came close to a framework accord on Kashmir that some diplomats feel could be picked up again. It seems to me the Americans have to assist the Pakistanis where it matters most. Heavy-duty diplomacy, not just military assistance like F-16s and night vision goggles or doling out $1.5 billion in development aid a year to a weak civilian government. About Afghanistan. Diplomacy would go a long way towards alleviating the situation in Afghanistan, too. No matter how many troops Obama sends and for what purpose, there needs to be a parallel effort on regional diplomacy. The U.S. cannot rely on military force alone. I know this from personal experience. Through a Pakistani New York Times correspondent who works closely with me, I have gotten to know quite well, a fighter from South Waziristan. In numerous conversations in Peshawar, he has explained that fighting is a way of life for the people of Waziristan. They fought off the British, he always reminds me. The Massoud tribe of Waziristan was the only tribe the Brits could not subdue. And guess what? The Massouds are the central force of the Pakistani Taliban. By the way, my Taliban fighter friend describes Al-Qaeda, he calls them the Arabs, as ever present in South and North Waziristan. Present in the marketplaces, easy to see, but always keeping a bit of a distance from the ordinary Taliban foot soldiers. My fighter friend persuasively argues that the Taliban will fight until the foreign occupiers leave Afghanistan. More foreign troops, more Taliban fighters, he says. And his argument has been borne out on the ground. Prince Turki, the former head of Saudi intelligence, had some interesting suggestions for how the Americans should handle Afghanistan. Suggestions he made in an op-ed in the IHT, I might add. He said, call in all the stakeholders in the region, China, Saudi, Russia, Pakistan, get them to work at ways of eliminating the Qaeda leadership. China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia have long-standing vendettas with Al-Qaeda and will contribute intelligence and other resources to help get rid of them, he said. China and Russia might like to see the United States stew a bit in Afghanistan, but they also don't like Al-Qaeda. And in that same Herald Tribune piece, Prince Turki said what I mentioned earlier. America should push India and Pakistan to solve Kashmir. The US is well positioned. Washington has leverage over India because of 8 years of huge generosity under the Bush administration that continues today under Obama with the new civilian nuclear deal. And Washington has leverage over Pakistan because of the military and civilian assistance. It's about time the US used this leverage to save Pakistan before it becomes too late and Pakistan becomes another Afghanistan. Remember, Pakistan does not have just 30 million people and a ragtag military. It has 170 million people, a disciplined military that is custodian to a working nuclear arsenal. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'll be much more comfortable. Thank you.
Jane, thank you very much. We've got about 20 minutes, I may let things run over a little bit, but if I do and you have to leave bang at 2 o'clock, don't be shy. Any questions to start off? From there, please.
I was reading something about the things you were talking about a couple of weeks ago, and one of the arguments I read about was that the army, which is, as you indicated, political in the past at least, doesn't want the conflict with India to end. You know, it's part of their raison d'etre, and that they'd actually, I just wonder if any meaningful discussions are being held, whether the army might be tempted to step back in and try and eradicate the civilian government. Thanks.
No, I think I said General Kiani, the chief of staff of the army, is not interested in toppling the civilian government. He's made that perfectly clear. The army, though, is sort of encroaching more and more on in matters of governance. Not in any particularly, I'm not saying in any particularly secretive way, but the army leader is meeting with the leader of the opposition. He seems to have a good relationship with the Chief Justice. And so I think there's not going to be, if you're asking if there's going to be a coup, the answer is no.
As a follow-up to that, what is General Musharraf's role? Does the lion really sleep, or is he where his sympathies and activities lie?
I think Musharraf is irrelevant and his days are over.
You like short answers. Ben.
I mean, look, he tours the world. He goes to London, he goes to New York, and he makes speeches, and he gets a lot of money, and he's promoting a book, and he's got people calling up newspaper publishers, and then he goes and has lunch with them. But inside Pakistan, there's not the slightest bit of interest. And if he came back, he might have some problems. So I think it's kind of wasted space.
Could you comment on the work Richard Holbrooke's been doing? I haven't read too much about it in the media. And how long you think he'll stay in his role as special envoy? And if and when he leaves, is that a strong signal about a change in U.S. policy?
I would never predict what Richard Holbrooke is going to do or how long he's going to stay anywhere. I think it is quite noticeable, though, that he's been relatively silent.
Sorry, just get that closer to you.
He's been relatively silent in the last 2 months or so. And I thought it was very interesting that in her press conference at the Foreign Ministry last week in Islamabad, Hillary Clinton said, and I will be personally supervising the Pakistani policy. So I'm not sure what his, he's still there, he's still got a huge staff, they're all running around trying to do things. But I don't think that if he leaves, I don't think he's gonna leave. I think that would be too much of a loss of face, but maybe his influence is waning.
I did forget to ask if you could please just let us know who you are before you ask the question. Over on the left, and then we'll come back.
Ijan Tharoor, time. What are the main complaints that...
Just talk.
There's been, you know, while Pakistan is... cracking down on militancy in South Waziristan, it has done next to nothing in dealing with Jaish-e Mohammed and Lashkar-e-Taiba and sort of the groups in the Punjab that are acting towards India. Do you see anything really happening and any kind of, and are the power brokers in Pakistan actually interested in doing this? And further to that, obviously, there's also the whole sort of group of forces coalescing around Quetta as well, the kind of the seeds of the old, you know, Afghan Taliban that still exist there. Is any kind of action taking place there as well?
Well, on the jihad, on the groups you mentioned, they are the jihadi militants that I mentioned in my talk, and I think that there is no sign that the government is loosening up their control or is turned on them. There's no sign yet that the government has turned on these jihadi groups. As for the Afghan Taliban around Quetta, the Pakistanis deny that they are there. They deny that Mullah Omar is there. And the Americans keep saying that he is there. And the Americans keep saying to the Pakistanis, if you don't take care of him, we will. And I think the Americans would really like to expand their drone attacks into Baluchistan. But I also think the Americans are smart enough to know that if they did that, they'd have all of Pakistan, not just 90% of it, up in arms. So I think they are, at the moment, the Americans are using a bit of caution on that.
There was a question way in the back, please.
My name is Imran. I'm from Pakistan, and I'm a cricket coach and cricket player in Hong Kong.
Great. My question is actually... The big national passion is cricket.
It is. As you all know that America is trying to occupy not only Afghanistan, they lost badly in Iraq, and hopefully they will be beaten in Afghanistan as well. And we really don't need anyone's dictation, such as America, how to live, and we don't need that 1.5 billion only, because as Pakistanis, we send $8 billion to Pakistan, which is... legal one, maybe much more than that is also going as remittances. So we simply just want America to get out of our, first of all, Afghanistan, and we don't need Hillary Clinton's or Americans or anyone's dictation how to live. We can live on our own, and we were going to save our country for sure. So I think we need to tell them, we need to send our message across that they cannot win that. The war they just started in Pakistan. Unfortunately, our dummy politicians, those who are sitting there and trying to take orders from this American administration and killing our own peoples for just very little money and for their personal benefits. Thank you.
I think what you say about the not needing the $1.5 billion is very much to the point and very interesting. I mean, in the scale of things, it is very $1.5 billion a year over 5 years for a country the size of Pakistan is very little. And it was very interesting that the richest man in Pakistan, Mr. Mancha, the head of the Muslim Commercial Bank, a very skillful businessman, said a couple of weeks ago, you know, I can bring in $7.5 billion tomorrow if you want it. It's just too bad that he and the president are at loggerheads over certain things. So if they could get together, if the Pakistani political elite would just get their act together, maybe Pakistan could save itself. But at the moment, I don't see that on the horizon. I'm not saying they need America to do it, but it would be good if there was some internal cohesion, and you might be able to achieve what you're talking about.
Sure. I mean, we never had dedication before in Pakistan, not much awareness as well. But now since, I mean, I'm professional here, play cricket and run my business, but now I'm in politics. In fact, I have nothing to do with politics, but just to protect our country and to save it, and the bad name and image we're getting around the world just because of these dummy puppets and politicians. So we want to get rid of them as soon as possible. We're trying to activate our Pakistan wherever they're living, and we got enough talent around the world. We are professionals, we got good name. So we just want to get rid of, first of all, our these politicians by bringing Imran Khan in politics, which we are helping him, and I'm sure that we're going to do it and we'll really fix it.
I'm not so sure about that, but let's see.
Colm.
Yeah, it's kind of a related question. What do you think are the prospects of reform of the political parties, internal reform, in terms of greater democratization? Because as you know, a lot of the parties are run pretty much like family businesses. So do you see any hope that there might be a way to instigate reform or encourage reform?
I wish I knew. Look, I'm a journalist. I'm not a political operator or political theorist. I wish I knew the answer to this, but I think the chances of reforming the political parties at the moment is very slim. I'll give you an example of why I think that is the case. In 2007, a very interesting grassroots movement grew up, the lawyers movement. And they fought very hard, you know, massive rallies, very well organized, to try and get the Chief Justice back on the bench, who had been fired by Musharraf. And they were absolutely passionate about getting the Chief Justice back on the bench. And in the end, earlier this year, they did, for reasons that are too complicated to go into. But my point is that this lawyers' movement has not diversified or taken on any other issues. They are not interested in, for example, extrajudicial killings in Swat. Just turned the other cheek. Not interested in what goes on in the political parties. Each member of the lawyers' movement remains wedded to either being a member of the Pakistan People's Party or being a member of the Pakistan Muslim League under Nawaz, and they participate not at all in any kind of political reform in the parliament, in by-elections, nothing. Just a totally narrow, self-centered movement. So that example, you know, this promising grassroots movement with a lot of brains and a lot of talent, but just sticking to this very narrow issue and not taking on the broader issue of democracy in the country is quite disappointing.
I think we have time for two more questions in the back.
Dazan McLean from National Geographic. I was wondering if you could, the issue of Balochistan, which you mentioned a little bit back there. I was lucky enough to visit there in 2007 and talk to various Sardars and fighters, and I had not realized before then that they are really totally discontent with their situation within Pakistan, and there is a guerrilla war basically going on there. They're being slammed by the Pakistan military, there are human rights abuses. And as well, Balochistan is the place where China comes into play because the Chinese have a huge investment in the deep water port of Gwadar. And I've kind of lost track of that. Maybe you know what's going on right now with the Chinese in Gwadar. They seem to have suspended their construction.
I have to confess I'm not an expert on Balochistan. It's a place which is basically off limits to foreign correspondents as well. The Chinese have scaled back on the port in Gwadar, but the Chinese are very active in other kinds of development assistance, which in the Pakistani eyes, and for understandable reasons, is much more effective than the American assistance. The Chinese tend to build roads and dams, and they bring in their own workers to do these things, and it's great development. So if you're asking basically what is China's reputation or what's China's standing in Pakistan, it's very good because most Pakistanis see China as a long-time friend and as a friend that brings development without assistance. They don't say, like the Kerry-Lugar bill did, please make sure you have civilian control of the army. Please make sure that the civilians have a say on who the promotions are in the army. I mean, the army actually had quite a valid case when they protested about the conditions in the Kerry-Lugar bill. I mean, it was kind of intrusive language, which most countries would find infringing on their sovereignty. And China doesn't do those things, as we all know, when it gives aid, especially in Pakistan. In answer to Balochistan, there is a civil war, but I really can't speak to it. I haven't written about it. It's not something that really impacts on the mainstream of our coverage, which is sort of seen from a sort of the strategic point of view of Pakistan vis-a-vis the United States. So I can't speak to it.
If there isn't a last question, I'll help myself to it. Oh, go ahead.
Aaron Dingham. Would you be able to say what India's view is of what is going on in Pakistan? And I mean, I think that the Indian would not like to have a Taliban-led Pakistan.
I didn't hear the last part of your question.
Does India have any view on what's going on expressed publicly, given that it could be dangerous for them to have a Pakistan infiltrated or led by the Taliban?
Well, I don't think India's too happy with the internal situation in Pakistan, and this is expressed in the aftermath of the Mumbai attack. I mean, the Mumbai attack in November 2007 was devastating. And it has made revival of talks very difficult. I think there may be some possibility, hopefully, when Prime Minister Singh goes to the White House in a couple of weeks' time. The Indian Prime Minister is being given the first White House state dinner by Obama, and maybe the Obama administration, after not doing anything these first 9 months on trying to bring Pakistan and India together over Kashmir, might make it move when Singh is in Washington. I'm just speculating about that. I don't know.
Happy to take another one, actually. It's in back corner. Sorry, we do have one more question. Sorry, Kenneth, my bad.
Thanks very much, Rachel Cartland. Your talk was obviously absolutely fascinating, but really in essence somewhat sing. Do you see any rays of hope anywhere, and if so, what would they be?
Well, I would see a ray of hope if the United States got serious about this. If the United States got serious, or somebody got serious, about starting some talks between Pakistan and India. Because, as I said over and over again, until Pakistan feels secure, more secure, doesn't feel that India is this overwhelming power that they as a smaller country can't cope with, and that they as a smaller country must have these proxy militants, nothing's going to change. It's just going to get worse. So I think it's, frankly, I think it's up to the Obama administration to somehow find a way to push away the India lobby, which is very powerful. The United States has given India an enormous amount of encouragement in the last 8 years, ending up with the civilian nuclear deal this year. The United States has enormous leverage. And this is the most central foreign policy problem facing the Obama administration. I mean, Afghanistan, similarly, can't be seen in isolation. And even if he sends, no matter what number of troops he sends to Afghanistan, there has to be some parallel diplomacy so that the countries in the region just don't see the United States in there battling the militants. There has to be some effort to resolve the long-standing tensions. So until that's done, no, I don't see much hope.
Keith.
I can just throw in one, though. How active is India in Afghanistan? Are the Pakistani fears justified?
Well, if I was in Pakistan's shoes, I wouldn't be too pleased.
And if I could ask the last question, soft city correspondents like your colleague Keith and myself like to be reminded what it's like out there in the real world. You mentioned in passing no-go areas. I'm curious if those no-go areas have always been there and what the general travel situation is. Have you found that in the past 6 months you can't go to places you used to be able to go a year, 2 years ago?
The pattern has been, I've just been there 2 years, and the pattern it remains pretty much the same, but the uncertainty within that pattern has increased a lot. So by that I mean the tribal areas are off limits. I've been on four or five trips to various parts of the tribal region with the army, and it's always fascinating. But I cannot go as unescorted by the army, A, because I'd never get permission, and B, it would just be too dangerous, be really foolhardy. So the tribal region where this militant nexus is stewing away is off limits. You can go. I do go to Peshawar a lot. It's only a 90-minute drive from Islamabad. This is one of the dirty little secrets of covering Pakistan. It's a great road, and you can go up to Peshawar and you can stay there. But Peshawar has become more and more uncertain. As you know, there was a big terror attack last week. But those terror attacks are in places where foreign correspondents wouldn't go. I mean, you're not going to go down into a downtown market area anyway. And you can't walk the streets of Peshawar. But you can go to Peshawar and meet people who come in from the tribal areas. So that's basically the MO. You go to Peshawar or Karachi, some extent Lahore, and some other places in Punjab to meet various people. But the travel is pretty restricted, and it's getting more tense.
Thank you very much for a really fascinating talk on such a critical area. Please join me in thanking Jane today. And as is our tradition, we do have a gift for our speaker. It's that big fat job offer from the Financial Times we've been talking about. So I'm sorry, Lynn, she doesn't work for you anymore. Thank you very much.
Keep me warm in Shanghai.
Earthquake victims who never got their villages fixed.
Can we put you up against the wall?
Yeah.